one more rule when you come to the microphone. If there's no one at the microphone and you've got five questions, please ask one question, let me respond. Second question, let me respond. Yesterday when I was doing this, somebody came up with a microphone with four questions. I couldn't remember all the questions. So I do request that. And if things get lax at the microphone, I got a pile of new scientific discoveries discovered literally in the last 10 days that we can talk about that have a bearing on science faith issues. So don't worry about things getting lax. So we already have some of the microphone. So I'm not going to get to these wonderful scientific discoveries. But you know what? If you go to our website at reasons.org, we have a feature there called Today's New Reason to Believe, where we talk about an emerging scientific discovery and how that will put to the test different facets of belief. And it's free. You can get an article sent automatically to your computer. Another feature is a podcast. It's an audio podcast on Science Newsflash. We do that two or four times a week. That's also free. So if you want to hear about these amazing new scientific discoveries and how they impact faith, just sign up. Anyway, you're first. Go ahead.
Good evening.
Good evening.
We were talking about, somebody asked you yesterday about, they asked you a question about, do you believe in global warming? And I saw Wednesday in the LA Times, they had a female polar bear that swam 9 days to find an ice floe.
Right.
So all you people that don't believe in global warming should ask that polar bear.
Well, Al, I do believe in global warming, so what's your question? Thank you.
I think it's more like a... Paul, in this letter to the Hebrews, gives a biblical definition of faith. He said, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. This is a misuse of the word evidence. It is hoping something is true without seeing any evidence that it is. How do we collect evidence of things unseen? All evidence that science uses is seen directly or indirectly. Quarks and dark matter, for instance, are accepted as part of reality based on their observed effects. Quantum theory is tested by measuring observed results. What do you say to that?
Well, yeah, a couple of things. Hebrews, we're not sure who the author of the book of Hebrews is. Some say it's Paul, but there's a lot of evidence it's not Paul, so the author is really unknown. Clearly, it was an author who was writing to Jewish believers as opposed to Gentile believers because of all the references to Judaism in the book, and that helps us understand the context of that author's statement about faith, and he refers to faith in things unseen. And actually, I think you've said it quite well. As a physicist, I have never seen an electron, but I've got unshakable faith that electrons really do exist. So there's many things in science that all of us scientists are persuaded must be real, and we act our lives according to reality, these things, even though we've not seen them with our eyes. And the author of the book of Hebrews is making the same point about God. No one can see God. Paul said that in Timothy, that it's impossible for us to see God. Matter of fact, I think it was about a year ago we had a conversation. If you could see God, he wouldn't be God.
Paul didn't even see Jesus.
So, just because we can't see God doesn't mean we can't prove his existence. Just like I can't see an electron doesn't negate the possibility of my proving physically that an electron must exist. The same thing applies to God. That's the point that the author of the book of Hebrews is making, and that our confidence in the existence of God can be as certain as our confidence in the existence of a proton.
That is a misuse of the word evidence.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, his point is that you don't have to see things to call it evidence. There are other ways of making detection. For example, we cannot see exotic dark matter. But what we can see is that exotic dark matter must exist because it's influencing the effect of gravity. And that's how we detect exotic dark matter. Not through the light, because it doesn't give off any light, but we notice that their gravitational influence is coming from a region of the sky that can only be attributed to exotic dark matter. So with great confidence, as an astronomer, I can tell you 23% of all the stuff of the universe is exotic dark matter, matter made up of particles that does not interact with light. So I don't have to see it to know that it's real. And the same thing applies to God. I don't have to see God to know that he is real. And that's the point that the author of the book of Hebrews is making, saying our confidence can be as certain as it is in other things that we can't see. Okay, next question.
Hello, Dr. Lewis. I have a question about Genesis. I'm wondering, is there any reason or data to believe that God had stuff from dust? You had a photo of you. You take a direct mutation, not slow evolution, not super, but direct intervention of one such supernatural power to advance the DNA and create new species. It didn't happen by accident, it didn't happen by natural forces. It's that God had that ability to create human beings. Is there any reason why in Genesis or in the Bible or anything else, it indicates that it happened with only two people? Normally you have to have a large number of mutants in order to define each other and make their own. This is probably how it happened with other species. So why would it be possible or would it be reasonable to assume that a number of creatures occurred at that time? And that the history goes so far back that it becomes so mythical, not that it's unfair, but that it's easy to detail the things as opposed to the details of the crucifixion of the right hand.
Right. Well, there's actually an ongoing debate amongst different Christian theologians and Christian research scientists on the issue of whether or not the entire human species can be traced back to a single man and a single woman. There are believers who take the point that it was a population of bipedal primates and that God selected two from that population and called them Adam and Eve and endued them with the spirit, and we're all descended from those two. The orthodox position that the church has held for a couple of thousand years is that, no, the entire species is indeed descended from two people that God specially created, independent of all the other bipedal primates that may have existed on the earth. Now, some of the data that's being thrown at this issue are DNA studies. And the DNA studies, basically it's mitochondrial DNA, which traces the ancestry of humanity through the female line. Now, all of us have mitochondrial DNA, men included, but we only get it from our mothers. Our fathers have nothing to do with it. And all of us men in the audience have Y chromosome, and that's something that's only inherited through the male line. And so what geneticists do is they sample Y chromosome DNA over the entire population of the world, look at the diversity, and then try to discern the past history of the change in the mitochondrial, pardon me, the Y chromosome DNA. And it's supplemented by the fact that they dig up men that have been dead for thousands of years in different regions of the world, recover their DNA, and compare that DNA with the DNA of people that are still living. But it's people that are still living where we actually get the bulk of the data. And that, over the last, 25 years, has been moving down towards one man. I mean, it's still true that the evidence simply shows that we're descended from a single man or a few men. But the error bars on that have gone from 1 million men maximum down to 100,000 men maximum down to less than 1,000 men maximum. I mean, it's kind of heading towards the biblical statement. And the data is most strongly pointing to a single man. Now, the bad news is it's going to be very difficult to try to force that research to any greater precision. And it's because the human population is becoming very mixed up. I don't mean that politically, or, but in terms of our genetics. I mean, we live in the Los Angeles basin. What you're seeing is people of different ethnic groups are intermarrying. Well, what that does is it makes it much more difficult to trace the ancestry of this DNA. In fact, people are doing research in this area saying, we need to get this project done in less than 10 years. Because within 10 years, it's going to become impossible to use living human beings as a marker for the history of the change or the evolution in human DNA. That's not entirely true. I mean, we could rely on digging up dead people. When you dig up dead people, often it's difficult to determine the date that they died, what ethnic group they were part of. That can still continue. And that will work best with the most stable populations on the planet. But what's interesting is we're down to only 5 stable populations on planet Earth. What I mean by that are peoples that marry within their own kith and not outside their kith. If you want to know who they are, that's the Estonians, the Finns, the Jews, the Armenians, and the Japanese. Although with the case of the Japanese, it's starting to erode at a fairly rapid rate. So that's kind of where all the research is going right now. But both on the male side and the female side, it's heading rapidly down to a single man or a single woman. The theologians come in on this and make the point that Jesus, the Apostle Paul, as well as Moses, all taught that we're descended from a single man and a single woman, that were supernaturally created by God. But you raised a good point coming to the microphone. The Bible does lay out options. What does it say of Adam? His body was made from the dust of the earth, but his spirit was created de novo by a miracle outside of space and time. What does it say of Eve? That she was made from a biopsy from Adam's side, which means that God would have had a DNA template from Adam that he could re-engineer to make the woman. And then you have Genesis chapter 2 using the word Yatsar for how he created Adam and Eve, which means that it's a combination of God taking existing material and manufacturing it and taking, actually creating from beyond space and time. Now that opens up a whole lot of options for the rest of the animals on planet Earth. From a biblical perspective, God could create them from DNA templates from other species, or he could create them brand new from beyond the physics of the Earth and the space-time dimensions. And he also creates them, according to Psalm 104, with the capacity to adapt, at least to some limited degree. Because there's making the point that when God creates a species of life, it is able to survive on the Earth in spite of the Earth's changing environment. So it means that they're created with some capacity to adapt. So in that context, the Bible would predict that creatures are created with the capacity for microevolution, but not macroevolution. And indeed, that's what we see. And actually, it's a smart way to create. Instead of having to create a new species every year, you only have to create them every few hundred thousand years, or every million years, or in the case of a cockroach, every quarter of a billion years will do just fine. So, anyway, next question.
I have a question about the flood. I've been in your class a while. I know that you had perspective of flood as being a local event and not a global event, referring to the North Flood. When I think about that, the reason that's puzzling is in order for the flood to remain local, it would be a boundary line that could hold the water in one place. I don't know if the Middle East or around Israel has such geography for that. And if it did, if there was some sort of bowl shape there that could keep a flood local on these lands.
Right. Okay. Good question. Some time ago, I delivered a message to an audience that all believed in a global flood. And I purposely titled my talk, Noah's Flood, Worldwide or Global. And I did that because the Bible, as you go through it, frequently refers to worldwide events where in the context it defines it as less than the entire globe. Now, just to give you an example, it talks about Joseph feeding the whole world. But if you read the whole context, he was feeding all the provinces of the Egyptian Empire. That was the whole world of Joseph. And likewise, when it says of King Solomon that the kings and queens of the whole world came to his court to hear of his wisdom, it also tells you 2 verses later that the kings and queens came from as far away as southern Arabia and Ethiopia. So evidently the ruling king in the Incan Empire didn't make the journey. But that was the whole world of King Solomon. And when Peter talks about the flood, he makes reference to the flood at the time the event takes place. It's a Greek phrase, cosmos tote. Now, the word cosmos can mean the whole universe, it can mean the whole earth, or it can mean the whole nation, or the entirety of your backyard. I mean, all that would apply. But what Peter is doing, it's 2 Peter 3, verses 5 and 6. He uses the word cosmos tote. What the tote adjective does, it says the world at the time the event took place. And what he's doing is he's contrasting the world of Noah with the world of Rome, and making the point that the world of Noah was not as large as the world of Rome. Well, those are a few of the passages that you can go to. But if you, I've actually done this, gone through the entire Bible, looked up all the passages where it uses the word worldwide, and in no case does it refer to the entire globe. Which means that all the passages that need tell us that the flood was worldwide don't necessarily imply it was global. Another principle you can bring to bear on this is if you read through the entire Bible where God pours out his judgment wrath, the judgment wrath is always limited to the extent of the reprobate behavior. And what I mean by reprobate behavior, well, a good example would be Sodom, where it says that every man in the city, young and old, came to Lot's door to commit homosexual rape against his guests. So it means that it's ubiquitous. Everybody is at that level of evil behavior. But that when Abraham was talking to God about the coming judgment in Sodom and Gomorrah, at one point Abraham said, well, what about all these evil Amorites that are living in the hills with me? And he said, their evil has not yet reached its fullness. I will not touch them. It will only be the cities of the plain. Which makes this point, that if reprobate people had not yet settled Greenland and Antarctica, God would not flood Greenland and Antarctica. Now, we've revised our model of the flood from probably the last time you heard me speak on it. Why? Because one thing we've done at Reasons to Believe is to calibrate the Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 genealogies. You can do that because of an historical date that we have for when Abraham lived, about 4,000 years ago, and when Peleg lived, he's halfway down the genealogy from Noah to Abraham. And it tells us in Genesis 10, verses 25 and 26, that the world was divided in the days of Peleg, which I believe is a reference to the breaking of the great land bridges that took place at the end of the last ice age. And that would actually explain Genesis 11, where God scatters people over the whole face of the earth. That would require land bridges in the context of the technology they had at that time. We have excellent carbon-14 dates as to when those land bridges broke. The last of the land bridges to break was the bridge over the Bering Strait, joining Alaska to Siberia. It broke 11,000 years ago. With those two dates, you can demonstrate that Noah was probably alive in a neighborhood about 40,000 years ago. Well, at that time, most, if not all, of the Persian Gulf was dry. Excuse me. Got a little allergy kicking up here. Most or all of the Red Sea also was dry. And therefore, what we believe happened with the flood is that the Persian Gulf was inundated, Mesopotamia was inundated, and probably a good chunk of southern Arabia was inundated. So we've actually made our flood model about 3 or 4 times bigger than it was about 10 years ago based on this new evidence. And I think what also confirms that model is it resolves the problem you see in Genesis chapter 2, where it tells us that the Gihon, the Pishon, the Tigris, and the Euphrates all came together in the Garden of Eden. And thanks to satellite imagery, we've now recovered where the Gihon and the Pishon flowed. They flowed through southern Arabia. At the end of the last ice age, those were major rivers equal in size to the Tigris and the Euphrates. And if you trace the ancient riverbeds of the Gihon and the Pishon, and the Tigris and the Euphrates, as they enter into the Persian Gulf, they all meet together in what is now the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf. And so you can go to our website and actually have a map where we think the Garden of Eden is. But it would also help you flesh out what the flood must have looked like at the time of Noah. And keep in mind that all you need is a berm at the Hormuz Strait, and that could back up a lot of water. And there's actually geological evidence that there's an ancient berm at the Straits of Hormuz. Those are the straits right at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, that would back up water. Moreover, it's not necessary that you would have permanent standing water. A flood of that nature would put a huge snowpack on the mountains surrounding that whole region. As that snow melts in the days following the end of the rain, that would produce a flow of water into Mesopotamia, the Persian Gulf, and Saudi Arabia that would keep water hundreds of feet high. And therefore, you would not be able to see the distant hills and mountains. And by the way, it tells us in Genesis 7:19 that the distant hills and mountains were not seen. It says all the highest mountains that were covered with water. The verb modifying the noun har for mountain means elevated. All the elevated mountains / hills. By the way, the word har that's translated mountains can also be translated hills. In fact, it can be translated all the way down to a little mound that you would have in your backyard. The thing about the Hebrew language is it has very few nouns. And so the nouns tend to have much broader definition than they do in English. It simply means that when the flood was at its peak, Noah and his sons on top of the ark could not see any land. It was just water from one end of the horizon to the other. Now, as evidence that that's the correct interpretation, in Genesis 8:5, Noah gets up on top of the ark with the waters receding, and it tells us he can see the distant hills and mountains. Then in Genesis 8:5, he releases a dove. The dove flies over the water. Because it's flying lower over the water than where Noah is on top of the ark, it says in the text that from the perspective of that dove, water covered the whole face of the earth. And therefore the dove returned to Noah. And it's actually the same phraseology you see in Genesis 7:19. So there's nothing in Genesis 7:19 that would imply that the water had to cover the whole globe, only that the water covered at least from one end of the horizon to the other from the perspective of somebody standing on top of an ark that's 45 feet high. Okay? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, I might want to define the term for the benefit of those that may not have heard of this. And by the way, not all Christians believe in a rapture. Some do, some don't. But as the term you'll not find anywhere in the Bible. But it has its origins in the writings of the Apostle Paul, where he talks about a time that would come towards the end when instead of having hundreds of nations in the world, we have a 10-nation confederacy ruled by an oligarchy, and how this would bring about oppression among the peoples of the world as it was in the days before Noah and after Noah, when you only had one government running everything. And it's kind of like antitrust legislation. If you let a single corporation have total control over a product, typically in their greed what they do is they lower the quality of the product and they raise the price. And you know, since our government is aware that that tends to be the behavior of monopolistic corporations, they have laws to prevent that from happening. They stimulate free market competition. In fact, our interpretation of Genesis 11 is that's exactly what God did. He saw that the peoples of the world after the flood were setting up a monopolistic government, and God knew that was a prescription for oppression of the citizens, so he says, no, we're going to have multiple nations, multiple languages, free market competition for the citizens, and use that as a check against oppression. But there are passages in the New Testament that predict that people will once again say, no, we want to have a single nation broken up into 10 provinces that will be over the whole world, and this will make for a much more efficient system. Well, it's true. It would make for a much more efficient system, but it's also a temptation for oppression. And during the time when the oppression reaches a peak, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 refers to God intervening and removing all the followers of Jesus Christ from planet Earth bodily, just literally taking them away. And I don't know how the rest of the population will explain that. They might say, well, the aliens have come and have taken hostages. That could be a good way to cover up that kind of an event. But it tells us that that event will lead to nearly a third of the Jewish population becoming followers of Jesus Christ, and then those Jews going out throughout the entire world in the midst of this great oppression, bringing people from all ethnic backgrounds to faith in Jesus Christ. But it talks about how that period of oppression will be ended by the return of the creator of the universe. Jesus Christ, who was here a couple of thousand years ago, will come back with all the raptured saints and all the dead in Christ. So the dead in Christ would rise and receive their new bodies, and the raptured saints would return with him and put an end to all the oppression, and then set up a 1,000-year reign where Jesus Christ becomes the president of planet Earth. So we will have a one-world government that will be righteous, but it won't be one set up by human beings. And during the millennium, you would have these raptured saints and people who died in Christ before the rapture. And they will be morally perfect, but they will not have children. But the people who survive this period of oppression, who become Christians, will have children. And there'll be a population boom during the time. And during that entire time, it says Satan will be locked up. The false prophet will be locked up. Jesus will be ruling in downtown Jerusalem. You'll be able to see him on television every night. And he'll have, as magistrates with him, all of these morally perfect Christians, which means no longer can you blame the government. I don't know what comedians are going to do anymore, but you will no longer be able to blame the government. You won't be able to say, it's poverty that made me sin, because there won't be any poverty. People sometimes think that eating meat's the problem. And God says, no, we're going to have everybody back on a vegetarian diet. In fact, there won't be carnivorous activity at all. We'll be feeding the carnivores, so they won't have to kill. What God is doing during the millennium, this thousand-year period, he's taking away every excuse for why we rebel against his authority. He says, you know, it's the government, that's not going to be a problem. The police, that's not going to be a problem. Poverty, that's not going to be a problem. Carnivorous activity, that's going to be taken away too. And he can't say the devil made me do it. He's going to be locked up. So what it tells us in Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10, the reason why we rebel, the reason why there's evil in the world, is because the human heart is evil beyond imagination. It's our hearts that are responsible for all the evil. It's not our external environment. But people don't believe that. So for 1,000 years, God takes away all the externals. But at the very end of the millennium, he releases Satan from his prison and sends him out to put to the test all the children that have been born. And what does the text tell us? The majority of the children will choose to rebel rather than to submit to the authority of Jesus Christ. Again, proving that the rebellion is all the result of the human heart, not the lack of evidence. And people say, well, you know, didn't know that God existed. Well, he's there on TV every night, so you won't be able to have that as an excuse. So all excuses are taken away, driving home a point. And then after the millennium, God will remove the universe from existence, replace it with a brand new universe. You can read all about it in my latest book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, over there on the table, where I talk to you about the physics of the new creation, the dimensions of the new creation, and why we'll be able to have the level of relationship and happiness in the new creation that's impossible in this creation, this universe, even if you're morally perfect. Because one of the things about this universe, we're all constrained to linear time. And because we're constrained to linear time, it puts a serious constraint on our capacity to relate to one another. The dimensions of length, width, and height also put a serious constraint, as does thermodynamics and gravity and electromagnetism. But all that will be replaced with brand new laws of physics and brand new space-time dimensions. And what I try to do in the book is encourage you with how wonderful life is going to be in the new creation. But God needs to teach us a few lessons first. So that's kind of what the whole story of the rapture in the thousand-year period is all about. Okay.
The Ark of the Covenant.
But God needs to teach us a few lessons first. So that's kind of what the whole story of the rapture in the thousand-year period is all about. Okay.
The Ark of the Covenant, is that that houses the, we're supposed to include the tablets, the two tablets,
right.
The Ten Commandments,
right.
That was written by God?
Right.
Now, does anybody know where the Ark of the Covenant is?
No.
Okay. Now,
I saw the movie.
Now, I have a kind of a silly question, but that's because I'm a silly person. But I was just wondering. Now, Moses, when he went up to Mount Sinai and he got the Ten Commandments, he came down, saw his people were idolizing another god,
mm-hmm.
right, a calf, a golden calf. He got angry and he smashed the tablets. Is that correct?
Correct.
Did you have to go back up and say, God, I need another copy?
That's what happened.
Exactly?
God gave him another copy.
I mean, you're not being
facetious? No, not at all. I mean, you can actually read about it in the book of Exodus, how he had to go back up the mountain a second time, and then God gave him another set of tablets. He took that down. That's what's in the Ark of the Covenant. But if you want to know what happened to the Ark of the Covenant, Jeremiah speaks about it. Jeremiah chapter 3 and 4 address the subject of the Ark of the Covenant in the context of modern day and basically makes a prediction that it will never be found, another one will not be built. And so those movies, according to the book of Jeremiah, we're never going to find the Ark of the Covenant. And moreover, if the Jews ever put up a third temple, there won't be an Ark there in the third temple. So that spoils your science fiction enjoyment? Well, so be it. Go ahead.
I have an astronomical...
Yeah, can you come a little closer to the mic? Thank you.
Okay. I have an astronomical question. Maybe I'll wait that one. On the January 28th, it says the sun unleashed two powerful solar eruptions, and also NASA has devised a new tool to battle against massive eruptions of the sun. Now, recently I have heard, actually last night, I heard about blackbirds dropping out of the sky for some reason and landing in Arkansas and Indiana and maybe some other places. And also thousands, maybe millions of fish being washed into Chesapeake Bay and New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, was that close by? Would that have anything to do with the solar massive eruptions that are either smoldering, ready to erupt, or irradiation? And also, how does this tie in with Luke 21? I kind of have an idea anyway, because I'm into prophecy, but for people who don't know anything about this, Luke 21, there'll be great earthquakes and pestilences in various places, a fearful event, the great signs of heaven, there'll be signs of the sun, moon, and stars, and so forth. So I'm wondering, would these birds falling out of the sky and all this different fish have anything to do with these massive sun eruptions?
Well, I'm going to give you a short answer, but if you want a complete answer, it's available in a podcast we did on that the very day they were talking about all these blackbirds and fish. So if you go to iTunes or reasons.org, you can listen to our 20-minute audio response to that report. But I'll give you a brief comment, and that is that this kind of thing happens all the time. The way the news report was announced, it made it look like it was a total extinction of these birds and fish, and that wasn't the case. It was a few thousand birds being impacted in one state of the United States. And, you know, there are natural phenomena that will cause, you know, widespread death over a short period of time of certain species. And it's been observed literally for hundreds of years. It's a routine thing. So it's nothing to do with the atmosphere. It's nothing to do with the sun. Although, that's a little overstatement. In one of the cases, it was a lightning storm that triggered the mass death. But I can tell you it's got nothing to do with the coming solar maximum. So now, it is also true that in late January, there was a solar eruption. That was fairly significant. And again, this is routine. The sun goes through an 11-year cycle. Where it has a few sunspots and a few solar flares at solar minimum to solar maximum, where you got lots of sunspots and lots of solar flares. And we're a year away from solar maximum, about a year and a half away from solar maximum. So I'm all excited because our Reasons to Believe organization is organizing an Alaska cruise. And so I'm telling all the Californians, if you've never seen the Aurora Borealis, this is your big chance, because the best time to see the aurora is during solar maximum. Incidentally, it's not out of the question to see the Aurora Borealis here in the Los Angeles Basin. I saw it once in the late 1970s, but all it was a little kind of pink spot in the sky that didn't move much. Where I grew up in Canada, you would see Aurora Borealis that would cover the entire sky, all different colors. It'd be wildly dancing across the sky. As an astronomer, it was a tremendous annoyance because sometimes the aurora would get so bright we couldn't see the stars and galaxies behind it. And we literally had to shut down our telescopes and wait for a few weeks until the aurora had quieted down. But it is a spectacular display. Right. However, the data we're seeing from the sun so far is indicating that this solar maximum is not going to be that spectacular. There was one in the 50s that was truly spectacular. And actually, that's kind of a good thing, because if we had another solar maximum like we had in the 1950s, it would probably knock out a number of communication satellites. And you know, as my sons put it, that would be the end of civilization as we know it. So. Well, there's a big buzz on the web about 2012 being a time of worldwide disasters, and it's very much overblown. By the way, we have a number of articles and podcasts on our website that are pretty dismissive of all this 2012 speculation. However, we do indicate a worst-case scenario, which would be the knocking out of, say, several GPS satellites. And that would be a problem for many people, because we've gotten very dependent on GPS. And but the good news is there are corporations that are busy to launch new GPS satellites. I think within 5 years, they're going to have GPS satellites so accurate, you'll be able to position things to within 18 inches, as opposed to, say, 10 or 20 feet, which means you'll be able to track your teenagers. I mean, this would be a wonderful tool for all the parents out there. So, okay.
That previous question on the flood just shows you how the writers of the Bible, of the Genesis, were so ignorant of the rest of the world that they thought it was a worldwide flood. So, yeah.
Well, Al, if I could just quickly respond to that. Until the 20th century, that's all people spoke about the world. Only in the 20th and 21st century have we become global citizens. So if you just go back to your great-grandparents here, when they spoke about the whole world, that was the world that they knew of, as opposed to the entire planet. And as you go through the Bible, you notice that the world, when it talks about worldwide, it gets bigger and bigger as time goes on. Because
people didn't write it in the Bible, that's
something. So.
Okay. So, the Bible, contains a lot of good things, but it also has a lot of nonsensical things. And let me just give you a
thing. Yeah, give me one.
One question. Okay. Matthew attests to a horde of zombies.
Matthew?
About Jerusalem. What about that?
I didn't see the word zombies in my New Testament.
Matthew 27:52-53.
All right. I know what that's a reference to. It says, of following the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth from the dead, several hundred other people within the Jewish nation were also raised from the dead, but they were raised Lazarus style, not the way that Jesus was raised. When Jesus rose Lazarus from the dead after he'd been dead for 4 days, he came back with the same body he had before he died. So he may have been 60 years old when he died. He came back a man 60 years old. In other words, he had all the wrinkles and gray hair and chipped teeth that he had before, and he lived a few more years and he died. The people that were raised to life following the resurrection of Jesus into a perfect body, they were raised with the same kinds of body as Lazarus. So they all lived for a few years, a few decades, and then they died. Paul makes reference to this in the epistles where he says there are still people present here who were raised from death to life at the time of the resurrection. He says you can still talk to them and they'll tell you their stories. So he was making the point that this is not a myth. This is a real event that took place, and these people are still available for you to talk to. Now, what we also notice is neither the Jewish historians or the Roman historians refuted that event. And typically when something is nonsense, it gets quickly refuted by the contemporary leaders and historians. In this case, that did not happen. And that's why Paul is able to say, look, these people are still alive. The evidence is still here. Well, there were eyewitnesses at the time of the Apostle Paul.
The whole Jewish nation would have converted instantly.
Well, actually, that nearly happened. It tells us in the early chapters of the book of Acts that within a few weeks after Jesus rose bodily from the dead, half the population of Jerusalem became followers of the Christian faith. And that wouldn't have happened unless the evidence was very substantial, given how much the Jews as a people fought against the ministry of Jesus when he was alive. So the evidence had to be very strong to explain that event. Yeah, go ahead.
From the audience, in Luke, Christ tells the repentant thief on the cross next to him, today he will be with us in paradise.
Mm-hmm.
In Ephesians, Paul says of Christ's second coming that the dead in Christ will rise first. Why didn't these dead immediately go to heaven when they ended?
Okay. There's this place called Paradise, and it's in the context of the people who died as believers in God and his coming gift of redemption through the creator of the universe that went to this place called Paradise. This is a place where Abraham would have been, Moses would have been, but they were waiting for the redemptive act to take place. And if you read what Moses said in the book of Deuteronomy, he made a strong reference in his last sermon. Put your faith in this future redemptive act, not in your capacity to obey the law. But most Jews chose the latter and not the former. But for those who did choose the former, they went to paradise when they died. Now, you'll also see in Peter's writings that Jesus ministered to the Old Testament saints that were in paradise and ushered them into the kingdom of heaven. And so what you see in Revelation 6:9, it refers to these saints who are sleeping under the altar in the kingdom of heaven. And it tells us that in their state of sleep, they're able to observe the events here on earth. In fact, Paul in Corinthians refers to the dead in Christ as being spectators. They're witnesses. And so we who are alive and following Jesus Christ are kind of like on the football field, whereas the dead in Christ are up in the stands watching. They can cheer, but they can't intervene. They can't go on the playing field.
Are you saying paradise is a different place than heaven?
Paradise is a different place than heaven. And right now, that paradise is empty. Jesus came and escorted the people in paradise into this place in heaven. However, the dead in Christ are still there in a spiritual state without their bodies. They're able to observe events, but they can't intervene, which is why it tells us in 2 Timothy that it's pointless to pray to these people. They can't do anything for you. We're to pray to Jesus. He's the only one that can intervene on our behalf. They are spectators. They're watching, but they're cheering. And when you cross the finish line, they'll be there to greet you. That's one of the first things that Jesus does to a follower of Jesus Christ at the point of death, is it introduces them to all the saints that have gone ahead that they knew. And they kind of have a little celebration, which is why when I do a funeral, I like to mention to people who are celebrating the death of someone that's a follower of Jesus Christ, that in heaven there's a celebration going on, and we should also partake in that same celebration. They have graduated. So it's like kind of getting your little, what do you call it, certificate of diploma, and you get to throw your hat off or whatever. Well, that's kind of what the death of a believer is all about. When the saints come marching in, right.
I have another last question for you. When Israel was looting and crossing the Red Sea, I've seen some commentary that says for a million or so people to cross in a period of a night, you know, how wide they have to be marching side by side, and how quickly everyone did across the course of the day. It sounded like it was impossible.
Yeah, that does tell us that the entire Jewish population and their Egyptian colleagues did cross the Red Sea in a single night. We don't know how long that night was because we don't know what time of year it was, so it could have been 6 hours, it could have been 14 hours, depending on the time of the year. But it also doesn't tell us how wide the dry portion of the Red Sea was, and there's some debate over exactly what the Red Sea crossing was geographically. So it may have been a relatively narrow body of water that was crossed, in which case you can get a lot of people across in a hurry. So it's kind of like looking at a bridge. How wide is the bridge and how long is the bridge? If the bridge isn't that long, you can get across it quickly. And if the bridge is really wide, you can get a lot of people across quickly. So there's really no population limit on that. But where I hear critics complain is they say, when the census is taken of the people that cross the Red Sea, it adds up to approximately 3.5 million people total if you count men, women, and children. And they said, how can that many people come from Jacob's family? Only 70 came into Egypt 4 generations earlier. Now, the generations are really long. I mean, we're looking at hundreds of years. But even so, they say it's very difficult to get that many people just from 70. So that's where the main body comes from, the higher critics of the story of Moses and the Jews crossing the land. But one thing you'll see in the text, it tells us that during the time of the 10 plagues, that Egyptians from all over the Egyptian Empire were joining in with the Jews. And that was a provision within the Jewish religion, is that anybody who was not a Jew could become a Jew simply by having the men being circumcised. And it tells us that people from literally the entire Egyptian Empire could see the blessing of God upon the Jews and all the plagues coming upon Pharaoh's people, and said, we're going to switch sides. And so, you know, biblical scholars who have studied this would argue that the people across the Red Sea were predominantly Egyptian from various parts of the Egyptian Empire, that they actually outnumbered the native-born descendants of Jacob. And that's kind of fitting with the Old Testament message, which is God placing the Jews in a place of the world where 3 continents come together, and where people had to cross through Israel in order to trade from one nation with another nation this gave an opportunity for the Jews to communicate the religion and encourage people to join in with their faith and either settle with them or go back to their homeland. And so, for example, there's a deep Jewish tradition in Ethiopia as a result of people trading, going back home, and taking their new religion with them. So evidently, that was quite widespread. And if you read the account of the 10 plagues, you could see why, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Egyptians would pick up the opportunity to leave the condemnation upon Pharaoh and join in with the blessing of Moses. Who's next? Okay, good question. And in young earth creationism, there's this belief that all the dating methods that we have to establish that the universe is 13.7 billion years old and the earth 4.57 billion years old are all based on radiometric dating. And actually, that is true that for the earth, the best methods we have for dating the earth are based on radiometric dating. It's not true of the universe. In fact, of all the tools we have for dating the age of the universe, the one that we use least frequently is radiometric dating. It is consistent with the 13.7 billion years, but even now, the error bars we have that are based on radiometric dating, it's 14 billion plus or minus 1.5 billion. And we have other measurements based on the distribution of galaxies and the hot and cold spots in the cosmic background radiation that give us dates for the age of the universe that are now better than 1% precision. So it's 13.72 billion years plus or minus 0.012 billion years. Radiometric dating is actually the least precise of all the tools we have, but it is true. All the tools that we have for dating the universe agree with the 14 billion year assessment. There are no dates that would support the contention of young earth creationism. And it is true also that astronomers are quite dogmatic on this, in the sense that in astronomy, you're not inferring the past, you're directly witnessing the past. It's different from all the other scientific disciplines in that it takes time for light to reach our telescopes. So, for example, when we astronomers observe the sun, we don't see it as it is now. We don't know what's happening in the sun right now. We do know what was happening in the sun 8.5 minutes ago. That's how long it takes the light to reach us. But because of that, we have direct access to what God was doing millions of years ago, billions of years ago, all the way back to when the universe was 10 to the minus 34 seconds old. That's about as far as we can go by direct measurements. But we can literally watch the entire history of the universe unfold simply by looking at greater and greater distances. And it's that capacity that allows us to come up with such confidence in our ascertaining the age of the universe. Now, in the case of the Earth, it's also true that all the dating methods we have are consistent with the Earth being 4.5662 billion years. We actually can measure the age of the Earth to five places of a decimal. It's 4.5662 plus or minus 0.0001. And that's quite accurate. And again, there's great confidence because that method is based on using uranium-238 decay, uranium-235 decay and thorium-232 decay. And what's interesting is those three radiometric elements decay into three different daughter products of lead. One into lead-208, another one into lead-207, the third one into lead-206. And lead only comes from the radiometric decay of thorium and uranium. All the lead that we have in the universe comes from the decay of uranium and thorium. And so what we can do is take a meteoritic sample and look at the amount of these three components of lead, look at the amounts of the uranium, 235, 238, and thorium-232. What that does is give you six independent measures of the date of that sample, and they all give you the same result, 4.5662 billion years. So that's why there's such great confidence. Now, the younger creationists have a response to all that. Their response is, they would agree that these dates are reliable, but they said old Earth creationists are making the presumption that the radiometric decay rates have never changed. And that is correct. We do assume that they have never changed. But as an assumption, we can test by direct measurement. In other words, we can look at a distant star and measure the radiometric decay rate when the light left that star. Or we can do that with a galaxy. And what it tells us is the radiometric decay rates have never changed. And likewise, we can take ancient rocks on the surface of the Earth, and we can look at xenon isotopes. And what those xenon isotopes tell us is that the early Earth had plutonium on it. Today, there's no plutonium. There's no natural plutonium anywhere on the Earth. But we look at these xenon isotopes, and they tell us that there had to be plutonium on the early Earth. Well, plutonium has a decay period of half-life of 82 million years. So it means that the Earth must be much, much older than 82 million years to explain why there was plutonium on the Earth, but today there is none. Now, if you want to read more on this, there's a book over there called A Matter of Days, where I make the point that the scientific evidence is conclusive and overwhelming that both the Earth and the universe are billions of years old, but it's also conclusive that humanity has only been around for a few tens of thousands of years. And I think that's really the way to resolve this. I agree with my young Earth creationist friends that humanity is recent. It's the Earth and the universe that are ancient. And really the best way to resolve this, I've learned this just through hard experience, that when I'm giving a message in front of an audience of young Earth creationists, do not lead with the scientific evidence. So, for example, a few years back, I addressed an audience of 1,200 young Earth creationists, and I just stuck with the Bible, basically making the point that if you go through all the creation accounts in the Bible, you get an overwhelming case that the creation days in Genesis 1 are six consecutive long periods of time. In fact, it's impossible to read the Bible literally and consistently if these days are only 24 hours. And the Hebrew word yom, that's translated day, has four different literal definitions. Part of the daylight hours, all the daylight hours, a 24-hour period, or a long but finite period of time. And unlike English, in biblical Hebrew, the only word you got for a long period of time is the word yom, that's translated day. In English, we got over a dozen words for a long period of time. In biblical Hebrew, the only word you got is yom. The point I make in my book is Moses had no other option to describe six long periods of time other than the one we see recorded in Genesis chapter 1. And actually, if you read Genesis 1, I think it's quite clear as to which of these definitions you use, because when it talks about creation day 7, there's no evening and morning, which means the day is not yet finished. And as you read throughout the rest of the Bible, the seventh day is when God brings evil to an end. So the seventh day must be a long period of time because evil is still here. And also if you read to the last of the creation accounts, Revelation 21 and 22, God creates again. The eighth day is coming. But clearly the eighth day has not yet started. And I'll give you one more, a little tidbit. Genesis chapter 1, it says, the human male and the human female were both made on day 6. When you read Genesis 2, Adam is made first, And there's a lot that goes on between the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve. I've added it all up, and at a minimum, I'd say you're looking at 6 months, if not a few years, between the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve. And by the way, during that time, Adam says, "I'm lonely." And you wouldn't get lonely in a few minutes at the end of a 24-hour day. But anyway, if you want to read more, more is available. Go ahead.
This is a little bit of a change of pace. I think there's some science for you, maybe not. And the, I want to talk about Melchizedek. And where did he get, where did he become so great?
Where did he become so?
So great.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings into the question about general revelation and special revelation. So that the idea here is that any, and then we have back in Hebrews where it says that Christ was a priest of the order of Melchizedek.
Right, right.
Indicating to me the greatness of Melchizedek.
Right.
And we know from Genesis also that he was greater than Abraham.
Right, right.
So, my question is, where would you put him in the hierarchy of the biblical saints?
Well, I think you've identified the two passages. In the book of Genesis, it tells us that Abraham paid a tithe to Melchizedek. And so the very fact that Melchizedek received this tithe from Abraham tells us something about who this Melchizedek is. And when you go to the book of Hebrews, it refers to Melchizedek having a priesthood that's higher than the priesthood of Aaron. And if you actually look at it in the original Greek, it tells us that Jesus has a priesthood like Melchizedek's, which is permanent and untransferable. Which is why many Protestant Bible scholars believe that Melchizedek is none other than the person of Jesus Christ. Because if this is a priesthood that's permanent and untransferable, then this can't be a mere human being. And would explain why he was so great and why Abraham paid him the honor and worship and presented the tithe that he did. So, now. There's a lot of debate amongst Christians. Was this Jesus in bodily form, or was he in spiritual form, or was this the angel of the Lord? But there's lots of biblical evidence that Jesus and the angel of the Lord are one and the same person. So maybe it's the angel of the Lord, Melchizedek, and Jesus Christ are all one and the same person, but they could be manifested in different ways.
Hello, Dr. Ross.
Hello.
Great honor and privilege to be here and to ask you a question. I heard in the media recently that Stephen Hawking made an appearance at Caltech.
Yes.
My question to you, sir, is what does Stephen Hawking teach? And what do you agree and what do you disagree with Stephen Hawking?
Well, I've heard Stephen speak several times myself. He comes to Caltech on a fairly frequent basis. And actually travels around to higher institutions of learning on a fairly frequent basis. And I have noticed that his philosophy has changed over the past 30 years. So he's not giving the same line that he was, say, 30 years ago. I still think he believes in God. But what I'm seeing him doing is he's drifting farther and farther away from the idea that God is a personal being. In fact, in his latest book, The Grand Design, he seems quite emphatic that God cannot be a personal being. Whereas when I heard him speak 25 years ago, he was open to the idea of God being a personal being, even though he personally didn't think so. But it seems like he's no longer open to the idea of a God being a personal being. But he's quite comfortable with God being responsible for setting up all the mathematics and the laws of physics and the space-time dimensionality, as long as God doesn't intervene beyond that. A friend of mine actually lived with him for 4 years, Don Page, when he was at Cambridge. Actually lived in Jane and Stephen Austin's, Stephen Hawking's home. and actually had daily Bible study and prayer with him and his wife. But what he observed is that Stephen was quite willing to participate in this as long as we weren't talking about a God that would exercise authority over his life. That seems to be where he drew the line. And it kind of fits with his writings where he says he's on a quest to gain the mind of God, to know as much as God knows. And that kind of tells me, well, that would fit with an individual who's not really prepared to submit to God as a supreme being over him, directing his life. He wants to be kind of like God, knowing as much as God knows. It also explains why he chooses these strange cosmological models that he adopts. He's been critiqued by a number of astronomers and physicists for doing that. But as I've written in my books, I think there's a good explanation for why Stephen is going after these arcane cosmological models. They're the only models of the universe that would permit a human being to know as much about the universe as God knows about the universe. So in that sense, I think there's a consistency to what Stephen Hawking is doing in his later years. Where he's going to end up, I don't know. I do know there's a lot of believers in his life. And if you want to dig into a little deeper his philosophy with respect to God and the universe, there's an interesting book where he debates his lifelong friend, Roger Penrose. He and Roger were responsible for the first of the space-time theorems, and it was those theorems that launched Stephen Hawking to worldwide fame. But they got together and did a book project in which they debated God in the context of the universe and physics. And it's an interesting debate because at least at that time, this book came out about 6 years ago, Stephen Hawking was defending a deistic interpretation of the universe, a God that creates the universe but then takes a 14 billion year long nap or vacation, as opposed to Roger Penrose, who took the theistic position that God had to be a personal being because of the evidence he saw in the design of the physics and the universe. Neither gentleman would be, at least in the context of that book, a Christian. But you got one who says God is personal, the other one who says God is not personal. But it's about a 300-page debate that they did in front of a public audience at Cambridge. Well, not a public audience, it was an audience of Cambridge students and faculty. So I got the book if you want to take a look at it. I think it's still in print, too. Okay.
Mm-hmm. We in the Middle Ages, human lifespan was only expected to be 30 to 40 years old. But it says in the Old Testament that Methuselah is expected to be about, I believe, 970 years old. And nowadays, we live upwards to 110 years maximum or so. What I've heard, different things. They were vegetarians at the time, so that's why they lived so long. What happened to human longevity?
Yeah, good question. It's something that Fuzz Rana, our staff alchemist, and myself addressed in our book on the origins of human beings. It's in the Who is Adam? And also addressed it in my book, The Genesis Question. So I'm going to give you a brief answer. And the brief answer is that yes, during the times before the flood, you had a few people that were living 800, 900 years, maximum 969 years. And that after the flood, God decreed that the human lifespan would be shortened to a maximum of about 120 years. And indeed, we seem to observe that no matter how healthy a lifestyle we live, we can't push much beyond those 120 years. So it seems to be an accurate scientific limit. And as scientists have looked into human biochemistry, it supports the idea that that really is a hard limit on how long we can live. Now, what we do in these two books is address how it might be possible for people to live longer than that in the days before the flood. And you addressed one, vegetarian diet. And what you notice in the Bible is when God decreed 120 years is now going to be your maximum limit, he said, you can eat all the meat you want now. Basically saying, since you aren't going to be living hundreds of years, there's no need to have a vegetarian diet. And the point is that if you do eat a lot of meat, you'll accumulate heavy metals in your body at a faster rate than if you're a vegetarian. But if you're only going to live 120 years maximum, it's really nothing to worry about. So I'm not encouraging people to go on a vegetarian diet. But if you want to, that's okay. Do as you please. But we also argue that's not sufficient to explain people living that long. That if you actually look at our chromosomes, they're designed so that as the cells are replaced, the chromosomes get progressively shorter and shorter in length. And that really is what guarantees that you're not going to make it past 120 years. The chromosome shortening will get so severe, it will eliminate the possibility of living longer than that. But one of the things I contributed as an astronomer is to make the point that there's a British astronomer and a Russian astronomer, Wolfendale and Oerlikon, who have spent about 30, 35 years of their life doing research on a particular category of cosmic rays. These are heavy nuclei, very fast-moving cosmic rays. And by heavy nuclei, they mean oxygen on up, oxygen all the way up to uranium. And what they notice is that the vast majority of cosmic rays are things like electrons and protons. And they come from everywhere. And they come at all different velocities. So we believe that most likely they come from all the supernova remnants that are scattered throughout our galaxy and other nearby galaxies. But what Wolfendale and Erkin point out is if you look at just these heavy nuclei, fast-moving cosmic rays, the evidence is they come from a single supernova eruption. And their research shows that that supernova exploded during human history and was relatively close. And they initially identified the Vela supernova as a culprit, because that is indeed a recent supernova eruption of significant magnitude. But in a recent paper, they said, we think we made a mistake, because we found a new supernova remnant that's 40 degrees across the sky. And we didn't detect it, because being so big and being so close to it, it's very difficult to detect it against the background. But he said that would have been a much closer supernova eruption. And also, we're talking literally just a few tens of thousands of years ago, which leads to this possible scenario. At the time of Noah and the flood, the supernova erupted. And so the people before the supernova eruption were not exposed to fast-moving, heavy nuclei cosmic rays. But after the time of Noah, we would now be exposed. Now, when you look at the different cosmic rays, those are the ones you've got to watch out for. A few electrons hitting you at low velocities isn't going to do a lot of damage. Likewise with the protons. But if you get a uranium nuclei flying at your body at near relativistic velocities, it's going to do a lot of damage to your proteins and DNA and RNA. And so I argue that that would limit our lifespan to 120 years. And I say, how do you explain the chromosome shortening? Well, this would be an ideal opportunity for God to step in and say, okay, we've got this cosmic ray situation. We're now going to make the telomerase activity more aggressive. And that actually has the impact of lengthening your lifespan. Because without that aggressive telomerase activity, we'd be dying in many less than 120 years from cancer. As it is, cancer is a major cause of death. But telomerase activity allows many of us to avoid a cancer death, at least for a few decades. And so we're grateful that we have this aggressive telomerase activity, even though it guarantees none of us are going to make it much past 120 years. Now, the other thing we've written about is that even in the days before Noah, the average human lifespan was much less than what we're enjoying here in the United States today. Because as you look at Genesis 5 and 6, most people were not dying of natural causes. They were dying because they were being killed by their neighbors. At least 19 of the 20 people were dying from murder as opposed to natural causes. So a few individuals made it to 800 or 900 years, but most people were dying in their 20s and 30s and early 40s. And so today we actually enjoy the average longest average lifespan, longer than it was in the days before the flood. And it explains too why God had to intervene. Given that evil was that far out of control, if he didn't intervene, the human species would have gone extinct. And so in that sense, the flood event is a rescue of humanity from certain self-extinction. So, but it's kind of fun to go through these Bible passages and kind of piece together what the population statistics must have been and what the physics must have been. But if you want to read about it in detail, probably the Genesis question is the best resource. It actually gives you a table of what was happening to the populations. You're welcome.
Another theological question for you, Dr. Russ. There is in the book of 1 Peter, chapter 3 and 4, to me, what suggests universal salvation. In chapter 3, verse 19, just before that, speaking of Jesus, he was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and made a proclamation to the spirits in prison, who in former times did not obey, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah, during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were saved through water. And then, a few verses later in chapter 4, verse 6, for this is the reason the gospel was proclaimed even to the dead, so that though they had been judged in the flesh, as everyone is judged, they might live in the spirit, as God does. Could you give your interpretation?
Well, this is a passage of considerable debate amongst Christian theologians. So I'm going to give you what I think the text is saying, but there are Christians of note that would take a different position. But I don't know of any Christian theologian that looks at these passages as supporting texts for universalism, the idea that everybody goes to heaven. And it's because that's something God wouldn't do, is force people to go to heaven that don't want to go there. I just did a funeral over the weekend and said, where you spend eternity is your choice. Heaven's a place where you submit to the authority of the creator of the universe for the rest of eternity. But if that's not your desire, you don't have to go. So God will send you wherever you want to go. It's your choice. So that's a powerful argument against universalism, because it's quite clear there are many people who don't want to submit to the authority of Jesus Christ. And we were just talking about Stephen Hawking, at least in his current condition, that's something he would not desire. So going to heaven would be a punishment for such an individual. And God's not going to force that upon you. And it's also consistent with the fact that when Jesus died on the cross, and made the offer to trade his moral perfection for a moral imperfection, he didn't force that. He's a gentleman. He says, if you want to trade your moral imperfection for my moral perfection, I'm willing. But it's your choice. He doesn't force himself upon us. So in that context, I don't think there's any basis for interpreting this as a context for universalism. What Bible scholars do with this text is make the point that before Jesus rose bodily from the dead, there were two places where the dead went. And they were waiting places. And this word that's translated prison could include that. I mean, for example, in Soviet Russia, they had the Gulag. But they had these waiting prisons, where basically when you got arrested, you went to this special prison, and you weren't sentenced yet. It was simply a place where you waited your trial. And the idea was, well, if you're acquitted, then you go home. And if you're found guilty, you go to the Gulag. And then people said, this is really what's going on here, is that both the people who have lived a life of rebellion against God and those who have lived a life of submission to God before the resurrection of Jesus Christ go to this waiting place. And Jesus referred to it in the parable he made about Lazarus and the rich man, where he said both of them were in a waiting place. but they were in two different compartments. They worked together, and there was a chasm separating the two of them. And so it was this waiting place for the righteous and this waiting place for the condemned. And therefore, there are scholars who look at this text and says, when Jesus went to this waiting place to preach, he was preaching salvation to those that would be delivered from the waiting place and taken to heaven. We spoke about that earlier. But also there are those who said that he was also preaching to the condemned so they would understand that their condemnation was deserved. And they did not go with them to heaven. Only the righteous would go with them to heaven. So he was basically saying, making it clear to all the dead before the resurrection,